case number 09-SC-1054. Mr. Riley versus people of the state of Colorado. Are both parties ready? Let me just make a few introductory minor remarks. Each of you have a half hour, and you'll have to keep track of your time. And please state your full name, who you represent, so we can check the record. Time to start. Proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Harbour, registration number 39020, representing Mr. Anthony Riley. The trial court committed reversible error in rejecting Mr. Riley's multiple assailants instruction, because that instruction was crucial to the jury's task determining whether Mr. Riley acted reasonably, and specifically whether he acted reasonably in defending himself against the concerted actions of two assailants. The charges against Mr. Riley arose from an altercation between himself and what I will refer to as a male assailant and a female assailant. An exchange of words occurred between the male assailant and Mr. Riley. Mr. Riley and the male assailant then began grappling. According to Mr. Riley's testimony at trial, the male assailant got a hold of Mr. Riley. Around this time, the male assailant ordered the female assailant to get the heat from a nearby truck. Mr. Riley believed that heat referred to a gun. Around this time, Mr. Riley struck the male assailant with a small knife. Mr. Riley was charged with offenses related to the female assailant and the male assailant. However, he was only convicted of offenses related to striking the male assailant. Mr. Riley's defense to these charges was that he was acting in self-defense. The crux of his argument was that he struck the male assailant in order to distract the female assailant and prevent her from getting a gun and shooting him. However, without a multiple assailants instruction, the jury was left uninformed of the fact that it could consider the actions of the female assailant in determining the reasonableness of Mr. Riley's actions. In fact, the jury instructions effectively instructed the jury not to consider such a defense in determining whether Mr. Riley acted reasonably. Specifically, the instruction on self-defense stated that a defendant acts in self-defense when using physical force to defend himself from what he reasonably believes to be the imminent use of unlawful physical force by the victim. The word victim was used in the singular. And as I mentioned before, the male assailant and the female assailant were each alleged victim in this case. By using the term victim in the singular in the self-defense instructions, the jury must have assumed that it could only assess the threat posed to Mr. Riley by each victim in isolation.
Excuse me, Mr. Arden, what about the totality of circumstances, apparent necessity instruction? Why didn't that cure it?
For two reasons, Your Honor. First off, the apparent necessity instruction did not inform the jury that it considered the actions of multiple assailants. The purpose of an apparent necessity instruction and a multiple assailants instruction are different. The purpose of an apparent necessity instruction is to inform the jury that a defendant can act on what he perceives to be reality rather than reality itself. The purpose of a multiple assailants instruction is to inform the jury that a defendant can act upon the actions of multiple assailants.
Well, wouldn't that be included in the apparent necessity instruction? I mean, just common sense, right?
No, I would have to respectfully disagree with that. I think that the language of the apparent necessity instruction isn't specific enough on the topic of multiple assailants to inform the jury that they consider the actions of multiple assailants. Secondly, I would argue that because the self-defense instruction used the term victim in the singular, assuming for the sake of argument that the apparent necessity instruction did inform the jury that it could consider multiple assailants, then those two instructions were intentional.
But weren't there two victims in this case?
There were two victims. However, the jury was instructed by the court to consider each charge against the victim individually. So if the jury was looking at the jury instructions without the multiple assailants instruction, it would consider the terms of each victim in isolation. In other words, it would consider whether or not Mr. Riley defended himself against the male assailant, and then whether or not he defended himself against the female assailant, respectively. Nothing in the jury instructions informed the jury that consider the concerted actions of the female assailant and the male assailant acting together. And that was the crux of Mr. Riley's defense, that when he struck the male assailant, he was defending himself from the concerted actions of both of those assailants.
Well, did Mr. Riley ask for a correction from the singular to the plural?
He did not, Your Honor, no. However, I think when assessing the harm of trial court's rejection of the multiple assailants instruction, the fact that the self-defense instruction uses the victim in the singular has to be taken into consideration. When our Court of Appeals has looked at cases similar to these, they've taken into consideration cases such as People v. Alders and People v. Manzers.
Counsel, while you're on that point, could you speak to the effect of this court's recent decision in Pickering on your arguments that the instruction here effectively lessened the burden on the prosecution? Do you continue to argue that point, or has that changed in light of Pickering?
I do continue to argue that point, Your Honor. I realize that it is arguably in tension with this court's opinion of Pickering. I would respectfully argue that to the extent that they are in tension, that Pickering was wrongly decided. But I would also argue that regardless of whether or not this is viewed under a constitutional harmless error standard or a non-constitutional harmless error standard, the reversible error occurred under either stance.
Can I ask one other question before you leave the totality discussion? What do you think about the Court of Appeals comment that seemed to feel that our holding in Beckett did not affect the earlier holding in Jones in any way? Would you like to comment on that?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think the Court of Appeals was correct. When this court issued its opinion in Beckett, it was reviewing the effect of changes made to the statutory language regarding self-defense, changes that were made in 1971. And this court determined that in light of the changes to that language, that an apparent necessity instruction was no longer required to be issued by trial courts because the thrust of that instruction was encompassed within the language that our legislature introduced in 1971. Jones was issued after that language was altered by the legislature in 1971. Jones was issued, I believe, in 1983. So when this court considered Jones, it considered the multiple assailants context within light of that legislative language, the same legislative language that this court considered in Beckett, and determined in Jones that a multiple assailants instruction is still necessary. So I don't think Beckett affects Jones' holding that a multiple assailants instruction is necessary.
Could I follow up? Did Jones, though, it appeared in Jones that we were requiring specific dealing with multiple assailants because that was part of the totality of circumstances that we seem to feel was not covered. In Beckett, didn't we seem to interpret the language reasonably believed to convey the notion that the totality of circumstances was required with regard to reasonable appearances?
Well, I think Beckett addressed that. It addressed the meaning of the apparent necessity instruction in the sense that the apparent necessity instruction instructs a jury that the defendant's perception of the totality of circumstances is what it should evaluate rather than what the actual circumstances were in front of the defendant. And I think Beckett concluded that, well, obviously Beckett concluded that the apparent necessity instruction was effectively encompassed within the language, the statutory language that is issued in self-defense cases. But I don't think that that language is encompassed, I don't think the theory of multiple assailants is encompassed within the stock instruction on self-defense that is given to juries. And I don't think that Beckett indicates that that is the case.
Mr. Arvin, let me follow up a little bit on both those cases and your request for instruction. I mean, superficially, it seems there's a little inconsistency between the two cases. I noticed that Chief Justice Quinn wrote the first case and then dissented in the second case. So I'm wondering, do we have to limit Beckett to follow what you're suggesting? Or do we have to deal with that? Does the court have to deal with the tension that is between these two cases? What's your view?
I don't necessarily see a tension between the two cases for the reasons that I was explaining to Justice Coates. I think that the circumstances of the two cases address are significantly different. Obviously, Jones addresses the necessity of multiple assailants instruction. Beckett addresses the necessity of an apparent necessity instruction. And I think because the purposes of an apparent necessity instruction and a multiple assailants instruction are very different, I don't think that Beckett and Jones are necessarily in tension. You know, again, I think that it is reasonable to conclude that an apparent necessity instruction and what the purpose of the instruction is conveyed by the stock language of self-defense instruction. But a multiple assailants instruction, especially in a case like this, where victim is described in the singular, is not encompassed in the stock self-defense instruction.
Thank you.
I was reading the transcript from the closing argument given by the defendant. And it seems that he very much anticipated in his closing comments the fact that the necessity described in the jury instruction was caused by both of the quote victims. The comments are very interwoven as between what the brother and the sister did, who was saying what to whom. Wouldn't that help a jury understand that apparent necessity had to be gauged against the facts of this particular case, since those facts were discussed so completely and thoroughly in closing argument?
No, Your Honor, because the jury was not issued a multiple assailants instruction, it wasn't able to apply the argument that defense counsel set forth in closing argument. And second, because victim was described as singular in the self-defense instruction, the jury was effectively told that it was told by the court that it couldn't consider the action.
Where was it effectively told that it couldn't? Which jury instruction was that?
In the self-defense instruction.
What was the number, do you know? Is it 21? When a person has reasonable grounds for believing and does in fact believe? Is that the instruction you're referring to?
Can I refer to my notes for 1 second here?
Sure. Because I'm not seeing that in 21. It could be 19, no. 21's got to be probably what you're talking about.
It's instruction number 20.
20?
Yeah.
All right.
It starts off, there's an affirmative defense to the crimes, then it lists several crimes.
Right.
And then under number one, it goes on, in order to defend himself or a third person from what he reasonably believed to be the imminent use of unlawful physical force by the victim.
Right, right. That's where the victim is used singularly. But let's turn to instruction number 21, which talks about the facts here, or at least closer to them. When a person has reasonable grounds for believing and does in fact believe the danger of his being killed or receiving great bodily injury. He may act on appearance, on such appearances, and defend himself. A person may act on such appearances, even to the extent of taking a human life, although it may turn out that the appearances were false, or he may have been mistaken. Isn't that an inclusive term, may act on the appearances of the facts as they have been presented?
I think
particularly when coupled with the closing argument, which talked about, didn't in any way try to separate. He was acting in self-defense with respect to the brother, or and he was acting in self-defense with respect to the sister. Basically said, here's what's happening. The brother was in his fight, and he yelled to the sister to go get the heat, and there was a knife pulled out. I mean, there was no sort of attempt to distinguish among, quote, the victims or victim. Isn't that right?
Well, I would argue that the apparent necessity instruction is not clearly an inclusive term, but it's not clear enough in light of Jones to inform the jurors of Ms. Riley's right to act against multiple victims. And while it's true, defense counsel argued extensively that Mr. Riley was defending himself against multiple assailants, I would argue that the self-instruction's use of victim in the singular, even if we interpret the apparent necessity instruction as permitting the jury to consider multiple assailants, I would argue that the self-defense instruction number 20's use of victim in the singular is in tension with the apparent necessity instruction. So the jury was left with, assuming for the sake of arguing the apparent necessity instruction does permit the consideration of multiple assailants, the jury was left in two instructions,
But I guess my point is that not even defense counsel argued that in closing argument. I mean, that was not the position of the defense counsel. The position of the defense counsel was, look at this overwhelming fight. These two assailants were ganging up on my client, and they not only were ganging up on him, one of them said, go get the heat. And here's what he did in response to that situation, to these two people who were ganging up on him.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I don't think that argument really had any effectiveness because the jury wasn't given the appropriate law to apply the argument.
Well, it must have had some effectiveness because he was found not guilty in all of the on attempted second-degree murder, first-degree assault, and menacing.
Well, we don't know exactly why the jury acquitted Mr. Riley on those charges. It's possible they found he didn't have the requisite mens rea.
Or that he was acting in self-defense. And he was found guilty of the charges which didn't require self-defense, right? The reckless crimes.
That's a possibility.
Well, it's not a possibility. That's in fact what happened. He was found not guilty of the crimes which did not require self-defense. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
So if we were to deduce anything from that, we would probably deduce that he was found not guilty of the crimes which required self-defense and guilty of the crimes which did not. So therefore, we would deduce that the jury made a distinction between self-defense and otherwise, right?
I would have to respectfully disagree with you on that. I don't think we can say for certain why Mr. Riley was acquitted of the crimes he was acquitted of.
Well, you could
of.
At least deduce that. We can never know for certain, can we? Because we're not back in the jury room.
That's correct. We cannot know for certain.
All right.
And I think in evaluating the harmfulness of the trial court's error, we should focus on the evidence that was presented at trial and Mr. Riley's argument. The crux of his defense was that he was defending himself from multiple assailants.
Mr. Arvin, I don't know about deducing anything from the verdict, but you started earlier to say that, you know, what the jury would have understood, and I believe you were talking about what they would have understood from these instructions. I guess what I'd like you to walk me through is how it is you think they would have been confused. It seems to me the strongest argument against you is that when you put all this stuff together, basically it says you know, appearances and totality, and they would get it. But you seem to be saying, even though it says you can act on reasonable appearances, even though we've talked, they've been told to consider the totality of circumstances, that the victim, the one that says you can defend against a threat from a victim, then nonetheless confuses them to somehow think that the threat from both victims together can't be considered. I mean, can you just walk me through that? Because I'm not quite sure I understand how they would arrive at that from these instructions. I guess I understand how they might be confused by these instructions, but I have a difficult time understanding how they would arrive at your conclusion, I think, which is that they believe they can only consider the force from one victim.
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, the jury was instructed to consider each charge separately, and each charge obviously pertained to each respective victim. So in evaluating whether Mr. Riley defended himself from the victim, the jury would have, for example...
So your argument essentially is the instruction that focuses on victim, together with the consider each charge separately, sort of trump over the reasonable appearances and totality of circumstances? Or are they inconsistent?
I would argue that they trump it. Even if they don't, I would argue they're so inconsistent the jury couldn't understand that, didn't necessarily understand that it could consider the concerted action of multiple assailants.
And so far as your, shall I say, trumping argument is concerned, I mean, that just sort of leaves us with victim trumps, circumstances trump, right? I mean, there's two arguments there, I guess.
I suppose so, Your Honor. I would argue that the use of victim in the singular is the only reference to the specific victims in the jury instructions. I guess I misstated that, but it's the only reference to victims in the context of self-defense in the jury instructions. So it seems to me that if a jury was, if they got to the point of deciding which trump which, they would have focused on that instruction that specifically address victims and specifically address self-defense.
Assume for a moment that the, which instructions trump is not very convincing. And you're left with a little confusion there. How should we determine whether that's reversible?
Well, I think with an inconsistency in the jury instructions like this, the court should assume that the jury did not necessarily follow the jury instructions, or excuse me, did not necessarily understand and consider the correct law regarding multiple assailants. And a case I cited in my brief, State v. Irons, from the Washington Court of Appeals, talks about this. It's a very similar case. In that case, the self-defense instruction used the term victim in the singular, and there was instruction given as well to the jury that is analogous to the inherent necessity instruction that was issued here. And in that case, the court found that because those instructions were in tension, it cannot assume that the jury understood the law regarding multiple assailants, and therefore found that the trial court in that case had committed reversible error.
So the doctrine that you're suggesting is that any tension in the instructions should result in reversal?
I don't know if I'd put it that broadly. I think in this case where the multiple assailants defense was the heart of Mr. Riley's defense on the charges he was convicted of, I think that sort of tension strikes at the heart of his defense and gives rise to reversible error.
How does the multiple assailants defense help us, though, with these reckless crimes that he was convicted of? I mean, isn't that the ultimate question we're asking here? Because he was acquitted of all the intentional.
That's correct. However, self-defense is still a defense to crimes with mens rea of recklessly.
It's not. I mean, look at instruction 20. It's very specifically not.
Ms. Arden.
Unless you misspoke.
Yeah, I don't think you mean it's a defense.
I don't think you meant to say that.
It's evidence of the mens rea.
But it's not a self-defense.
That's correct. I apologize if I misspoke. As Chief Justice Stoner pointed out, it is evidence towards the mens rea. And in this case, obviously, it was Mr. Riley's defense.
So he didn't, you're saying, and I just have trouble even articulating this exactly. You're saying that he didn't intend to act recklessly toward these victims? What were the exact crimes? Attempted, reckless manslaughter, and reckless second-degree assault. So he didn't intend to act recklessly. He didn't have the mens rea of recklessness because the jury was instructed about only one, about a victim instead of victims.
That's correct. Because his defense was self-defense, and because of finding the self-defense.
But self-defense doesn't count here, remember, because as the chief pointed out, his instructions correctly instructed, self-defense isn't a defense to reckless crimes. In other words, you can't act recklessly out of self-defense.
Well, Mr. Evan, isn't that precisely your defense? I mean, it's not an affirmative defense, but it's an element negating defense. I thought your defense was he acted in self-defense, therefore he didn't act recklessly, he acted reasonably.
That's correct. Because these instructions went to the reasonableness of Mr. Riley's actions, if Mr. Riley was acting in self-defense, he was inherently acting reasonably, and therefore he would not be acting recklessly. And I think Jones underscores the importance of an instruction like this in determining whether a defendant acts reasonably in a context of a case like this. Jones emphasizes that the determination of whether a defendant was defending himself from multiple assailants goes towards the reasonableness of his actions. If I could quote from Jones. Jones states the totality of circumstances, including the number of persons reasonably appearing to be threatening the accused, must be considered by the trier of fact in evaluating the reasonableness of the accused's belief in the necessity of defensive action and the reasonableness of force used by him to repel the apparent danger. So I think in the context of Mr. Riley's defense, in the context of self-defense, even if it's not an affirmative defense, I think reasonableness goes to the crux of whether or not the defendant committed acts that are alleged, the kind of acts that are alleged in this case.
Well, Jones didn't deal with the singular plural problem, did it? I mean, it seems to me you got a stock instruction here. And isn't there a rubric that's the singular includes the plural includes the singular, and, you know, based on all the questions that Justice Rice asked, it appears that it's questionable to me that there's any error at all, because it appears to me that the jury figured out what was before it. So it seems to me you're just, and this is a self-corrective kind of thing. I mean, the defense could have asked for the plural to be specifically inserted, but there are plenty of forms that people use every day where it appears to be the singular, but the context makes it the plural, and we give effect to instruments like that, don't we?
Well, I think that that's not adequate in a case like this, where the defendant's argument is that he was acting against the concerted efforts of both victims.
Well, he got his theory of defense, though, presented squarely to the jury, did he not?
No, Your Honor. I think multiple assailants was his theory of defense, and that instruction was not submitted to the jury. Of course, he argued that defense.
Right.
But without the multiple assailants instruction, I don't think the jury was given adequate law to apply that theory of defense. This court doesn't have any further questions right now, or is there a remaining time I have?
You may. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Lee?
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of People, bar number 38141. To accept the petitioner's argument, I think this court would have to accept three things. One, that as a matter of law, the trial court must give a multiple sale instruction when self-defense is not an affirmative defense. Two, that...
I'm sorry, could you just repeat the last phrase?
Oh, yeah. The first one that this court would have to find is that as a matter of law, a court must give multiple sale instruction when affirmative defense is not, when self-defense is not affirmative defense. Two, that the instructions as given did not cover the defendant's standard instruction. And three, its failure to do so unduly prejudiced his theory of the case. I submit that that is a three-step argument that breaks at every step. With respect to the first, and I think this is the logical starting point for this issue, and that is the question of whether a court must give multiple sale instruction when self-defense is not an affirmative defense. And in our view, a court does not. First, there's nothing in the Constitution, as this court said in Fink, in Case, and as recently as Pickering, that requires a court to give any self-defense instruction when we're dealing with a reckless crime.
May I interrupt you, counsel? Are you conceding then that a multiple sale instruction, in fact, must be given where self-defense is an affirmative defense?
I am not.
You're simply saying that Jones doesn't extend to a situation where self-defense may be considered in response to a charge of recklessness.
I am. I apologize for interrupting. Yes, that is what I'm trying to say. I think under the cert question presented, the only issue properly before the court is whether you need a multiple sale instruction for non-affirmative self-defense. This court's interested. I do not think that a defendant is necessarily entitled to multiple sale instruction when we're dealing with affirmative self-defense as well.
Okay. Ms. Lee, I'm a little confused. First of all, actually, in my view at least, Justice Rice's question of Mr. Arvin reveals the tension between self-defense, which requires a certain amount of intentionality, I think, and saying that some intentional acts, such as self-defense, can go to diminish or rebut or mitigate recklessness, which is a negligence concept. So we have that little problem. But then, as Justice Martinez points out, the reasonableness of whether a person acts in self-defense is the key issue in self-defense with respect to the mens rea, or the element of recklessness, right?
Yes.
All right. So isn't that really what, first of all, isn't that really what Jones says when you have a situation like that, it's reversible error not to instruct? I don't quite understand your argument there.
Yeah, then let me go into it. And that is the answer to my question, is no. I do not think Jones is dealing with conveying to the jury a principle that they have to reason, conveying to the jury a definition of reasonableness is how they consider
it. Wait a second, one other point.
Yes.
And then you can tell me.
Absolutely.
But if you define the defense of self-defense so that it excludes multiple assailants or doesn't mention multiple assailants, doesn't that carry over into the whole issue of whether or not the person acted reasonably in terms of the mens rea? So the argument that it just, that because the person was acquitted of the self-defense is almost irrelevant. It begs the question, doesn't it?
Yeah, let me see if I think it's the same answer to both questions, and let's see if I can do this cleanly. So in Jones, I don't think Jones stands for the proposition that the stock instruction is given forecloses the jury from considering any evidence. That wasn't the fact presented in Jones. The reason why the jury was prevented from considering evidence multiple assailants in Jones was because the court expressly instructed the jury not to consider.
Do we really know what the instruction that was given in Jones? I didn't see it anywhere in the opinion. It referred only to an omission of any affirmative reference to multiple assailants. But I don't know that Jones actually states the stock instruction or whatever instruction is ultimately given.
I would agree with that. I think where we make that inference is in the footnote when it's talking about what instruction should be given in remand. And it talks about how the court suggests that they should modify the pattern instruction. The tendered instruction, correct. But the part I'm focusing on is at the beginning of the Jones opinion, what the court was really dealing with was the court's explicit instruction to the jury and to counsel that they cannot argue multiple assailants to the jury. That just wasn't part of the self-defense statute.
Well, but I don't know that the court affirmatively instructed that they couldn't. I guess what I'm saying is I'm reading Jones to say that the problem was the omission of an affirmative reference to multiple assailants, and that the court rejected that tenor of instruction. We don't know what was actually said. This court then inferred from that omission that the jury was effectively restricted from considering that information, and therefore that was reversible error. But I guess what I'm having trouble making your leap here, that somehow a stock instruction was given in that case that affirmatively instructed the jury not to consider such evidence.
I could be remembering the case incorrectly, but I thought that apart from the instruction, that the court made a ruling, the trial court, that counsel could not argue multiple assailants. Because in a self-defense statute, he could only claim self-defense against Jones and not those who Jones was acting in association with. So I'm saying if that is the holding in Jones, and that was before it, there's nothing in Jones that conflicts with this court's other cases in Beckett and Hare. And the conflict I'm talking about is that there's nothing restrictive about the pattern instruction by saying that a defendant has a right to act in reasonable self-defense when he has a reasonable belief that he's acting against a victim. That doesn't restrict the jury from considering other evidence. I mean, that's what this court case, that is what this court said in both Beckett and Hare. To me, the problem in Jones.
Now, Mr. Lee, just for structure, have you moved on to your second point, which is really that the instructions as given adequately convey that you can use self-defense and as a net element negating defense with respect to multiple assailants?
I'm still on the first one.
You're still on the first one?
Well, I'm trying to argue that.
I thought in your first point you were trying to distinguish the element negating defense from the affirmative defense and say that even if Jones requires multiple assailant instruction with respect to self-defense as an affirmative defense, that it does not with respect to an element negating defense. Is that your argument on point number one?
It is, but I was trying to answer the question of whether you still need multiple, of the subsidiary argument that whether you need multiple assailants in an affirmative self-defense case. But
all right.
If I may return to the other.
I'm not sure what you referred to as the other, but go ahead.
Well, the other is, even if Jones requires an affirmative self-defense or multiple assailant instruction in affirmative self-defense, nothing in Jones would require in a non-affirmative self-defense context.
And I guess I'm having trouble understanding the difference. If you're defining self-defense as acting reasonably under the circumstances, and you're considering that in the context of recklessness charge, why would you define it differently, where the effect of that is to negate the defense and the affirmative defense, or to negate an element of mens rea in the recklessness context? Why would you treat them differently? What's the principal distinction?
Well, when we're dealing with the reckless as opposed to affirmative defense, it is just an element negating defense. And what I was trying to argue about Jones and the pattern instructions given is I don't think it does anything to foreclose a jury from considering other evidence outside that instruction. It's just saying here are a couple of things you need to consider when looking at self-defense. It doesn't say that other things aren't also self-defense. And when we're dealing with both affirmative self-defense and self-defense, we're still dealing with the legislature's statute 18-174. And there's just nothing in that statute which to me would indicate that they intended the defendant to get a multiple assailant.
Well, try coming at it this way. Self-defense is a defense to an intentional act. I didn't do it, or I shouldn't be held liable or culpable for doing it because I was acting in self-defense. Reasonableness negates mens rea. It would be a way of saying I wasn't acting recklessly, I was acting reasonably. Is that a fairly good way to talk about those concepts?
It is.
Okay, so what in light of that is your argument that this I was acting reasonably instruction with respect to the reckless crimes, I wasn't acting recklessly, I was acting reasonably, is that sufficient or isn't it? 21.
Oh, the pattern instruction?
Yes.
It is sufficient for...
Is it...
For reckless.
Right. So I guess maybe we've all gotten a little bit confused. What is your point then?
All I'm trying to say is that when dealing with affirmative self-defense, the reason why I think Jones suggested that you should add an additional part to the instruction saying the victim in concert with his associates was because you have to prove those elements for affirmative self-defense. That is a necessary finding that the jury has to make, because knowing for the underlying crime when firm assault defense applies doesn't hit that. But when we're dealing with the reckless crime, that is an overarching instruction, as you're pointing out, that it necessarily covers that we prove that the defendant did not act reasonably to the extent that self-defense is a defense that he was acting reasonably. So, and even if, and I guess I'll just turn to my second argument, even if multiple assailants is required in a non-affirmative self-defense case, the instructions here cover the defendant's tendered instruction. The apparent necessity instruction told the jury to evaluate the totality of circumstances, and if a person in the defense position, if they would have seen the circumstances as the defendant did and reasonably would have acted in self-defense, then it was self-defense.
Do you think, Mr. Lee, it would be fairer if the multiple assailant instruction was given?
I don't know how much more it adds, Justice.
Excuse me?
I don't know how much more it adds to the instructions.
Well, it specifically points out the theory of defense.
All it tells is the jury that they must consider evidence of multiple assailants.
Right. That's the judge saying it rather than the lawyer saying it in closing argument.
Yes. I would point to this court that the court did tell, and I guess this will go straight to harmless then. As when we look, defense counsel kind of argued that the closing arguments had less weight because they weren't coming from the trial court. And although that's true, I think we need to take the closing arguments along with the court's verbal instruction during closing, all in context. So what we had here was defense counsel argued, his final statement was, if the defendant thought that the victim had ordered his sister to get the gun, and he was acting under self-defense, he should have quit it. Right after that, the court came in with verbal instruction, which is cited in the brief, where it re-instructs the jury about the differences between affirmative self-defense and non-affirmative self-defense. And the court instructs the jury that if they find the defendant acting in reasonable self-defense, then they can acquit him of the charges, the reckless charges. And that, to me, is an endorsement of the instruction. Then we go to rebuttal closing, and far from arguing that that was an incorrect instruction, the prosecutor actually says as much. He tells the jury that if they find the only way that self-defense works to all the charges in this case is if they find that they believe that the defendant heard the victim tell his sister to get the gun. But our position was that he never said it, that the jury should discount that. So it wasn't an issue of law, it was a question of fact. And it wasn't disputed by either side. So I think taking those things in context, there's just no way that the jury would have thought they could disregard the defendant's theory of multiple assailants.
Did the defendant tender a theory of the case instruction? It's usually a 2:1. Do you know whether that happened here?
I do not know why. There's no.
The defendant asked for, although he did not tender, a multiple assailant instruction, did he not?
He tendered the one that is in the brief. Are you thinking of another one?
Well, I was thinking that, at the moment, I'm trying to recall, but I was thinking that there was a discussion to the extent that the court was aware of the fact that a multiple assailant instruction was desired. Am I confusing that point?
I don't know if we're thinking the same thing, but there is a discussion on the second trial transcript, I think in page 126 maybe, where defense counsel asked the court if they will give an instruction on the differences between affirmative self-defense and non-affirmative self-defense. They did not talk about the subject of multiple assailants.
They did give the instruction 20, which is the difference between the crimes which allow the affirmative defense and the crimes which don't. Is that, that's not what you're referring to, is it?
No, we actually don't know. The defendant actually never tendered an instruction. He just mentioned to the court that, her defense counsel mentioned to the court that she may be pursuing an instruction on it and asked the court for an opinion on it. And I actually think it's on page 126 of the second trial transcript. And then the court said that it was not important to do so.
But
other than that, no.
Just to be clear, the tender instruction was dealing with defining totality of circumstances, including the number of assailants, right?
Yeah, I thought, so there's, as I read the record, there were two instances where this concept came up. One where they're talking about there's two affirmative, non-affirmative, and then the multiple assailant instruction that we're dealing with.
Well, and the one tender instruction deals specifically with the reasonableness of the force.
Oh,
because of a number of persons, and that was rejected.
Yes, but I don't think that's been raised on appeals, and or is probably outside of the circuit question.
Well, no.
One more. I'm sorry.
Well, isn't is that Is that defendant's tendered, I think it looks like number five? I think that's the instruction that we're talking about here. The totality of circumstances, including the number of person, I think that's a mistake, reasonably appearing to be threatening the defendant should be the number of persons.
I think that's the appearance of the instruction, which I think that was given in very similar terms. That's instruction 21, I believe.
That was a given?
It says, I mean, my copy of the instruction says that was just tendered. I think the court gave a comparable instruction.
Well, comparable in that it was, totality of circumstances, but not comparable with respect to the specific reference to the number of persons as a consideration, correct?
Correct.
So why, and that's what I was trying to get to before, I just couldn't remember the specifics. I understand you want to call that a reasonable appearances instruction, but why doesn't that put the court on notice with respect to the request for an instruction concerning multiple assailants? Because that's what it asks for, regardless of your label. That's what it's asking for, isn't it? Number of persons is considered.
Yeah, I'm not going to dispute that, because I think the defendant, the multiple assailant instruction we're dealing with, obviously put the court on notice as well. So I don't know how that changes the calculus.
Okay, so here's how it changes it in my view. You've made this argument that that you look to the argument to show that, the jury would have had to have understood how to deal with multiple assailants with respect to an element negating defense. But ordinarily, I thought we looked to argument, not to replace instructions. The attorneys don't instruct the jury. We sometimes look to argument when there is a legal argument before us that the instructions have some ambiguity, and we look at the fact that neither the court nor the attorneys seem to sense that ambiguity, and we sort of looked at it to say, everyone understood this. But in this case, you can't say that because court specifically rejected an instruction with respect to multiple assailants, specifically saying that's a comment, I can't instruct on the number of assailants as a consideration because that's a comment on the evidence, not an instruction of law. And so how is it that you can then look to the argument and say, well, everybody understood this when the court clearly was intentionally instructing to the contrary?
Because I think it's an issue of how the jury understood it. And I think what the court thought is irrelevant to the extent of how the jury viewed instructions.
So your argument is that even if an instruction is erroneous, if the attorneys argue about it correctly, that's okay?
No, my argument is that, the principal issue in this case is, should the court have given the defendant jury instruction? And if so, and its failure to do so, did it prejudice his case to the jury? And I'm saying that independent of what the court thought, the ultimate question, the final question, is what did the jury think when they got these instructions and the arguments of counsel?
And we deduce that from, not just the arguments you're saying, we also deduce it from the instructions.
I do. And again, there's nothing to me, especially on the facts as we have here, that precluded the jury's consideration. Here, I guess the alleged limitation is that the pattern instruction said victim. And even under the defendant's testimony, and I think this is a critical point, his testimony was that he pulled out the knife to stab the victim in the neck because the victim ordered his sister to get the gun. I don't know how that's severable from the victim. I don't know how the jury could have received instructions as given and thought they did not consider the defendant's claim that the victim's order to get the gun could not be considered in determining whether the defendant acted reasonably.
In other words, what I mischaracterized, I suggested that what you're saying is, in order to discount that and not consider the totality of the multiple assailants, the jury would have really had to engage in a pretty technical reading of that affirmative defense instruction which uses the word victim, and somehow thought the lack of an S there overrides everything else they've been told.
Absolutely. And I think even in addition to that, they also have to look at the evidence in a skewed manner. So I don't know how you could possibly separate the defendant's claim that he defended himself because the victim ordered his sister to get the gun, that was not forthcoming from the victim. It was part and parcel too.
Well, don't you find it troublesome that the The court looked at this as a comment, this tendered instruction as a comment on the evidence rather than a legal instruction? I don't.
And this goes back to the difference between a non-affirmative and affirmative. Because when you're dealing with affirmative self-defense, it's an element that we have to disprove. But in a non-affirmative self-defense context, it really just is a view of the evidence. I should not be held guilty because, or I did not act recklessly because I was acting in reasonable self-defense. I mean, it really is not an instruction on the law. And it's certainly not one that I think the General Assembly intended. Because again, all of these instructions that we're talking about in 18.17.04.4 are in the context of the legislature telling courts that they should instruct the jury that they may consider evidence of self-defense as it relates to recklessness. And it seems
Mr. Lee, just in terms of the possible ways that the court could decide this case in your favor, one of them obviously relating to the last argument that you and I just discussed. Would you truly want the court to instead rest this case on a distinction between the element negating self-defense and affirmative self-defense and suggest that multiple assailant instruction is required with regard to affirmative defense, although the court need not instruct with respect to multiple assailants when it considers the element negating defenses, and end up with trial judges attempting to discern when they should instruct on multiple assailant and when they should not, or giving multiple assailant instructions that reference affirmative self-defense, but then say the instruction does not apply to the element negating self-defense with regard to the other charges. I mean, is that a path you really want us to take here?
No, just I agree that I think the simple, most straightforward way is there was no harm. The jury didn't read this technically. The evidence didn't really present this issue.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because that is just such an, I understand your argument that self-defense affirmative adds an element, and otherwise it does not. So you have a theoretical instruction there, which I understand. But going that route just seems to me would create such confusion in the trial courts and among the trial lawyers that I really have to question whether that's an important argument to make.
And I would agree to the extent that I do think those are important issues that we'll need to decide at some point. I do think this case is not the best vehicle for those issues, just given the fact that we did have affirmative and non-affirmative here. So that kind of complicates the matter, which I think those two things together make this not the best vehicle for the resolution.
Well, give us your best shot, though. What's the path through from your standpoint that causes the least trouble?
On the instructions?
Correct.
I think it should be, when we're doing affirmative and non-affirmative in the same case, or it's not affirmative. Self-defense. Well, let me answer both ways. Okay, so I think in this case, as it's done here, I think it would have been made much easier than instructions were on different separate instructions. So here's affirmative self-defense, here's what the people have to prove, but you could also consider self-defense on a separate instruction as it relates to recklessness. And whether or not you need to incorporate the parts of the statute as the defendant contends, I don't really know if that's clear on the face of the statute. Because it is just traverse, I think it's enough just to say that it's an issue just to have instructions like we had here.
Counsel, can I follow up to that? I mean, just to state it differently, I take it that you are not defending the result here on the rationale offered by the Court of Appeals, correct?
In part, I am on the grounds that I think you're right that the instructions as a whole convey to the jury what they needed to convey.
And that would have been sufficient to get to the result that you wish?
Yes, it would be.
So they went somewhat astray in their whole discussion of what happens with when a self-defense multiple assailant instruction is required. Is that your position, or?
Yeah, it's just that the court read, it used the affirmative self-defense instruction here to analyze it in the context of non-affirmative self-defense. And that to me was just wrong as a factual matter. But I would say in the end, as we're just standing here today, that I think the Court of Appeals did get it right to the extent that given the instructions given and the evidence presented and the arguments made by counsel, that it was harmless. There was error.
Thank you.
That was something we moved to.
So counsel, if we were to follow that path, what remains of Jones at the end of the day? I mean, the notion that when is a defendant ever affirmatively entitled to a multiple assailant instruction, and if the stock instruction covers it?
In my opinion, what the purpose of Jones is, it describes the best practice. When you modify the pattern instruction to include the defendant can act in reasonable self-defense against the victim and those acting in concert with the victim, it's the best practice because on appeal, we know what the jury found. We know that they proved everything that they had to prove. Because to be sure, as cases like Manzanares and Aldridge make clear, that when you get a totality of circumstance instruction, or you get the instruction that the defendant entered here, we can still presume that the jury found what we needed to find under the affirmative self-defense. But when it's actually in the pattern instruction, it's the best practice because we know they actually found part and parcel of the head fine.
So it's a nice idea, but if you don't do it, it's harmless?
It can be harmless, yes. And I think that's what the Jones opinion says.
Mr. Lee, may I just understand exactly what you're saying? In other words, you're arguing basically that Jones just applies to the actual affirmative self-defense, right?
Yes.
And that in a case like this where it's conflated with the mens rea, that you look at the facts and think it's harmless. Or in this case, your argument is essentially harmless, given everything, right?
Yes, it was no error at all.
Do you think that vitiates the clear language in Jones? Or do you think we have to say that or talk about the tension between Jones and Beckett?
I think people have had problems with the two. I mean, they're very distinct concepts, but I think in the end there really is no conflict at all between Beckett and Jones. I mean, Jones is dealing with affirmative self-defense and giving an idea of what's the best way to make sure we prove everything we have to prove, affirmative self-defense. It's not giving a broad statement on that the pattern instruction is given forecloses the jury from considering anything. I mean, that really is the point of Beckett, is the language of the defendant has a right to protect himself against reasonable appearances. That, by saying reasonable appearances, you're not precluding the jury from considering appearances that tend to be false. I mean, in the same line I'm saying, it's that same principle applies to the victim. By saying self-defense applies to the victim, you're not precluding them from also considering the victim and those acting in concert with the victim.
Well, what is the correct mens rea instruction for reckless?
That the defendant disregarded the substantial.
Mr. Lee, I want to go back to Jones because I think we're all of us struggling with it, and I was just trying to find the page site, and I can't. But it seems to me that Jones was the most concerned because the instruction there seemed to preclude, I think Justice Marquez was referring to this earlier, but that the instruction there seemed to preclude the jury from... let me just read it. Under the court's instruction, the defendant's apprehension of physical violence from others acting in concert with his principal assailant became an irrelevant consideration. That's quite opposite of what happened in this case, right? The judge didn't say you can only consider one and not the two of them acting in concert. It seems to have happened in Jones.
Absolutely, and that was the point I was trying to
make. And unfortunately, we don't really know what exactly was said in Jones because we don't have the instruction quoted in the opinion.
I would agree with that, save one exception. And maybe I'm referring too much, but I think when we're looking at Jones, the instructions just on remand. It wasn't that you should give the instructions on remand. It wasn't that you have to instruct the jury to consider multiple assailants in reviewing the defendant's right to act in self-defense. What they said is change the pattern and the affirmative self-defense element part. It was an issue of that the pattern instruction didn't convey to the jury to consider Evans' multiple assailants. I would think that the remand instruction would be more akin to that, but that's not what their suggestion was. It was really just tied to the affirmative self-defense element, and that way the court would know that the jury found what they're supposed to find in the affirmative self-defense context. So if the court has no further questions, thank you for your time and ask you for
thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Arvin, I think you have about a minute, a couple seconds for rebuttal.
In my remaining time, I'd like to address the argument that multiple assailants instruction is not required when self-defense is not an affirmative defense, as in this case. In the self-defense statute, it discusses when self-defense is not, when the jury is not instructed on self-defense, it's an affirmative defense, but it states that the court shall nonetheless instruct the jury with the self-defense law instruction. Now, I think that that instruction needs to encompass the relevant law concerning self-defense, and it needs to state the law of self-defense, correct? But because Jones focuses on the reasonableness of the defendant's conduct, I think that the self-defense law instruction, when the mens rea is recklessness, is essential in a case like this that it included in multiple instances.
Thank you very much, Mr. Armand. The case will be considered by the court. Thank both attorneys for your argument, and we'll take a 10.